This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Unfortunately, Haiti has for decades suffered from governments and governance that is not accountable, that is not just and inclusive. So although Haiti at one point was an enormously rich country, it has also suffered from this really troubled politics.
That's Vanda Felber-Brown, Senior Fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy and Technology and the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, speaking about gangs in Haiti and Kenya's intervention force. Details coming up. Also, Liberia will hold its fourth post-war election next Tuesday. And according to the World Bank, Sub-Saharan Africa's economic outlook remains bleak. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Gabon's coup leader has visited the Central African Republic seeking an end to sanctions imposed by the international community. General Brice Clotier Oligua Nguema insists that a military takeover was vital to save Gabon from iron-fisted ruler. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Gabon's coup leader, General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema, says he visited the Central African Republic Thursday to tell President Faustin Archange Touadéra why he seized power from Gabon's President Ali Bongo Ondimba on August 30. Touadéra is the president of the Central African Economic and Monetary Community, CEMAC, a regional economic bloc that has Cameroon, Chad, CAR, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon and Congo as members. Touadéra was also appointed by the 11-member Economic Community of Central African States, ECAS, to mediate Gabon's transition to constitutional order. ECAS includes all CEMAC nations as well as Angola, Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, and Sao Tome and Principe. CEMAC and ECAS suspended Gabon's membership and condemned the use of force to resolve political conflicts after Gabon's military ousted the president on August 30 and declared Nguema as military ruler. Nguema says his trip to the CAR after visiting Equatorial Guinea and Congo was aimed at requesting the lifting of international sanctions which were imposed to press for a return to democratic rule in Gabon. Nguema says he told Touadéra that the military takeover was vital to free Gabon from a very long rule that failed to improve living conditions of civilians. Nguema says the military junta needs time to restore stability, ensure sustainable economic development, conduct a national dialogue, and revise the electoral code before organizing transparent and fair elections that will usher in civilian rule. The junta leader said the military took over to avoid bloodshed because Gabon's opposition was preparing to take up arms to defend their victory that Ali Bongo stole in an August 26 election. He said Gabon citizens generally support the military for seizing power without bloodshed from Ali Bongo, who took power in 2009 following the death of his father, Omar, who had led the Central African country since 1967. CAR State TV showed crowds of Gabon citizens anxious to see Nguema. Some carried placards congratulating the junta leader for what they called his courage to save Gabon from the Bongo family's close to 60-year rule that did not develop the oil-producing nation. Rigobert Anta, who was among those gathered, told Gabon State TV that he is ready to return to Libreville after spending 7 years in exile in the CAR's capital, Bangui. He says in 2016, He was declared wanted by Gabon's government for protesting when Ali Bongo claimed he had scored 49.8% of votes to narrowly defeat his challenger, Jiang Ping, who had 48.2% of votes in that year's presidential election. Anta says he would be grateful if the military junta hands power to civilian rule within a maximum of 2 years. Nguema did not say how much time he needs to return to constitutional rule. The military junta says it will invite Gabon's citizens in exile for a national dialogue, but did not say when the dialogue will take place. Nguema promised to open an embassy in the CAR to take care of the needs of Gabon's citizens. Besides ECAS and CEMAC, the African Union and the United Nations have also imposed sanctions to exert pressure on Nguema to hand power to civilians. France, China, Russia, the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States have also expressed concerns about the military junta taking over in Gabon and are asking for a return to normalcy. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This week, the United Nations authorized a one-year deployment of a Kenya-led force to Haiti to help quell the violent gangs there. Vanda Philbab Brown is a senior fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. Last February, she wrote a commentary titled Haiti in 2023, Political Abyss and Vicious Gangs. In part one of the conversation she had with me, she starts out by describing the close ties the Haitian government has with the notorious gangs.
Unfortunately, Haiti has for decades suffered from governments and governance that is not accountable and that is not just and inclusive. So although Haiti at one point was an enormously rich country, it has also suffered from these really troubled politics. And it has oscillated between authoritarian governments, which were brutal, but and elected governments that nonetheless continued practicing very exclusionary rent-seeking politics and were highly corrupt. And in recent years, recent decades, the government have more and more relied on gangs, on organized gangs. At the same time, politicians and businessmen have used the armed gangs as a muscle for conducting illegal business, whether illegal political business or illegal economic business, and also to obtain votes.
Vanda, you're talking about gangs. You're talking about what? These impoverished young men controlling over half the capital? How could that be?
Absolutely. So especially in the capital in Port-au-Prince, the gangs control maybe 80% or maybe even 90% of the territory. The government controls really tiny slivers of the capital. And by control, really physical territorial control, with the gangs being able to prevent who goes into neighborhoods they control, who goes out, where the roads are accessible. So we are really seeing just a collapse of the state in Haiti, a state that has always been exclusionary, that has often been against the Haitian people instead of serving them, that is manipulated by the interests of the political and economic elite for their very narrow rent-seeking behavior against the people. But at the same time, the gangs, the armed muscle that the oligarchs have been using have become independent. They have slipped the leash. They are no longer just controlled by the politicians, and they are ruling territories, much of the capitals, expanding beyond, and they're also very brutal toward local populations.
And because of that, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry has called for foreign intervention to break the gang's siege and restore basic functionality. We come now to the present stage where the United Nations has authorized a one-year deployment of a Kenya-led force to the country to help quell the violent gangs. But you wrote that by any intervention, especially a temporary limited one, would face enormous challenges. So how will this Kenyan intervention fare in Haiti?
Well, we are yet to see. There are a tremendous amount of uncertainties as to what the intervention will seek to accomplish and what will the force posture be. The Kenyan government said they would contribute 1,000 personnel, much of it stemming coming from some of the elite police forces in Kenya that presumably have good capacities. Now, nonetheless, this force is meant to supplement the Haitian National Police. The assessment vary of how many police officers are left. Somewhere maybe on the high side of 9,000 police officers for the entire country, on the low side as little as 3,000. The gang membership is not well known, but there are maybe 200 gangs that coalesce in different coalitions. But the gang numbers, the gangs altogether, number perhaps in thousands of members. Some high estimates put the gangs at 10,000 members, 10,000 fighters.
That was Vanda Philbaba Brown, a senior fellow in the Strobe Talbott Center for Security, Strategy and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Hundreds of people took to the streets of the Kenyan capital Nairobi today to voice opposition to the LGBTQ community in a move opposed by rights groups as dangerous. The rally followed a Supreme Court decision last month that allowed a gay rights lobby to register as a non-governmental organization. Backed by religious groups, the demonstrators marched to the Supreme Court after Friday prayers at a nearby mosque, demanding the resignation of three judges involved in the case. Same-sex relations remain a crime under colonial-era laws punishable by up to 14 years in prison. Protest organizers said they will also march to Parliament to show support for a draft bill calling for the criminalization of gay relations with tough penalties, including up to 50 years in jail. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The International Monetary Fund says Africa will have a stronger voice with a third seat on the Global Lenders Executive Board. IMF Chief Kristalina Georgieva told the French news agency AFP about the new position as the IMF and the World Bank prepare for meetings next week in Marrakech, Morocco, the first gathering on the continent since 1973. Georgieva praised countries for being very prudent in dealing with inflation, which has gone down in many nations, and prioritizing public spending in a way that allows them to lower deficits. The World Bank warned in a report on Wednesday that sub-Saharan Africa's economic outlook remains bleak and that the region could face a lost decade of growth due to rising instability. The Sahel region in particular has been plagued for more than a decade by a jihadist insurgency that has fueled military takeovers in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. Despite the coups, Georgieva defended the IMF's decision to maintain aid to those countries due to humanitarian concerns. to Niger's President Kais Saied says his country is rejecting funds from the European Union because it does not want, quote, anything resembling charity or sympathy and won't accept it when it is without respect. In July, Tunisia and the EU signed a strategic partnership deal to fight illegal migration in return for financial support. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie Middle East Program, discussed this latest twist in EU-Tunisia relations with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi.
I think we're seeing a lot of contradictory statements coming out of Kais Saied lately. You know, he desperately needs this EU funding, but he has now really succeeded in turning his back on one of the only countries that's willing to bail out Tunisia. And we've seen at the same time statements from the EU that the Tunisian government actually did accept 60 million euros as part of this deal just last week. So it's not clear if he's turning the money away, if he's actually accepting it, but either way, he's shooting himself in the foot. I mean, he's in the press blasting this incredibly generous EU aid package that has gotten a lot of pushback and that Tunisia desperately needs. And it seems very much like this is just another page from the populist playbook where he's succeeding in alienating all of these so-called outsiders until no one's going to be left to support him.
Tunisia and the European Union in July signed a strategic partnership deal to fight illegal migration in return for financial support during a sharp increase in boats leaving Tunisia for Europe. Some European Union lawmakers, Tunisian opposition figures, and right activists have criticized the deal, arguing it will not curb migration, but will bolster the government of President Kais Saied, whom they accuse of autocratic rule. Do you agree with this assessment?
I do agree. I mean, first of all, what we've seen so far is that the number of migrants have gone up since this deal was signed. And I think additionally, you know, it's absolutely right to say that this is a deal that supports a dictator who has been blatantly violating the human rights of migrants. You know, the Tunisian government has so far been seen rounding up and sending migrants to the desert, to the borders with Libya and Algeria, without access to food, shelter, and water. And this has resulted in the deaths of migrants, including children. And additionally, you know, it's not likely that this deal is going to work out. We have seen no evidence so far in Kais Saied's tenure that he will carry out his side of the deal. And so I think that, you know, this is a lose-lose deal for everyone involved. It shows that the European Union has given up on promoting democracy in Tunisia and is solely focused on migration. And they're ending up sort of trading their morals and not likely to actually get migration to stop in the end anyway.
Tunisian authorities also denied entry to five members of the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee who were due to start an official mission to Tunisia. Tunisian President Kais Saied said he would not accept visits by foreign delegations that interfere in the country's internal affairs, and he claimed that these delegations want to play the role of custodianship over Tunisia. What's your take on that?
I think that this, once again, shows Kais Saied's inexperience in politics and diplomacy. You know, it's a completely normal thing for officials to visit their partner countries, particularly in the midst of negotiating this massive deal. You know, for example, Tunisia just itself concluded a visit to Algeria. I don't think that Kais Saied would say Tunisia is trying to be Algeria's custodian. And I think it's completely understandable that EU officials, members of the European Parliament, would want to understand the situation on the ground when they are offering Tunisia €1 billion. This is a completely normal way of doing business to go back and forth and visit each other's countries. And again, Saied is taking actions and making statements that are likely to harm Tunisia and Tunisia's most vulnerable citizens in the end.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Liberia will hold its fourth post-war election on Tuesday. Elections in Liberia are mandated by the Constitution, which provides that the President, Vice President, and members of the legislature be elected every 6 years. Incumbent President George Weah is seeking a second and final term in office. For more on the upcoming election, I talked to our reporter in Monrovia, Denise Nimpson.
As Liberians wrap up for the elections on Tuesday, political parties are also wrapping up with their campaign rallies. On tomorrow, the main opposition, Unity Party, will be having their Clamasos rally. They will be coming out. They term that as a victory march. So on tomorrow, Saturday, will be the main opposition Unity Party. And on the 8th to the 9th, yes, will be the ruling CDC will follow, also clamassing their political rally in Monrovia and across the country. So currently, Liberians are hopeful that the elections will be peaceful. There are a lot of peace messages ongoing currently. You have students, you have civil society organizations, the media. From diverse background, Liberians are preaching the peace messages as Liberians go to election on Tuesday.
Currently, there are 21 registered political parties, but it is unlikely that all these registered parties will field candidates in the presidential election. So talk to us about the front runner, which is WEA, and also the vice president, Joseph Boakai, who is the main challenger.
Okay, for the elections, the forerunner of the elections, the CDC happens to be the ruling party that is headed by President George WEA, the incumbent. And also, you have the main opposition, which is the Unity Party, headed by former Vice President Joseph Boakai. Also, you have one of the four runner-up opposition parties, the CPP, that is the Collaborating Political Parties, that is headed by Alexander Cummings. So, as it is now in Liberia, the race is actually between the CDC and the Unity Party, because you have with this issue of the government, there have been some complaints from citizens in terms of the economic hardship and all of that. So some of Liberians are saying there's a need for a change, and that change should come from the Unity Party. And others are saying they want to be with the incumbent to see how he can do better in his next term. That is his 12th year. That will be the second term. So as it is now, the tension a bit, you know, rising, because you have these two forerunners of the elections. You have their supporters that are in high gear in terms of how they elect.
So, Denise, have international observers arrived in Liberia, and are they ready to monitor the elections?
Yes. There are international observers that are currently in Liberia. Some of them include the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy, ISA. They have deployed their observers, short-term observers as well in the 15 counties. Also, you have the European Union Election Observation Mission that also deploy their observers. On today, they deploy their observers in the 15 counties of Liberia. 40 observers, the European Union Election Observation Mission, deploy across the country to ensure that they monitor the election process after the process and if there's possible second round in the elections. So there's an issue about this runoff, because Liberia, like you said, there are more than 20 political parties that are producing presidential candidates. So with the population, there's this likelihood that Liberia might have a runoff. That has not happened in many years, so Liberians are concerned about that.
That's reporter Denise Nimpson monitoring the upcoming Liberian elections from Monrovia. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded today to imprisoned activist Narges Mohammadi for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran, many of whom are removing their hijabs despite a harsh crackdown. A journalist and activist, Mohammadi has spent much of the past two decades in and out of jail for her campaign against the mandatory hijab for women and the death penalty. The head of the Norwegian Nobel Committee told the French news agency AFP that it urged Iran to release Mohammadi, a call immediately echoed by the United Nations. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Helen Cordian, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.